Coming up, democracy and a religious revival in the world's largest Muslim nation. Plus, Wisconsin monks who needed business advice and the online marketing experts who helped them build a $5 million a year business. And a rabbi describes the spiritual challenges of the Jewish High Holy Days, which begin next week, 10 days from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. There was divided reaction from religious leaders this week to President Obama's call on Congress to approve comprehensive health care reform. Quoting the late Senator Edward Kennedy, the president again called health care a moral issue.
At stake are not just the details of policy, but fundamental principles of social justice and the character of our country.
Liberal Protestants generally endorsed the president's proposals, but the Conservative Family Research Council branded them a government takeover and organized a live webcast to oppose them. The U.S. Catholic bishops welcomed, quote, the president's commitment to exclude federal funding of abortion. The bishops have called affordable and accessible health care a fundamental human right. More evidence that poverty in this country has been expanding. According to new numbers from the U.S. Census Bureau, the nation's poverty rate rose to 13.2% in 2008, nearly 40 million people. This is the highest level since 1997. 8 years after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, Americans say Muslims in the U.S. continue to face significant discrimination. According to a new survey from the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, 58% of Americans said Muslims are subjected to more discrimination than other religious groups. 35% believe Jews were the second most likely to face a lot of discrimination. Respondents said homosexuals face even more discrimination than Muslims. Nearly 64% said gays and lesbians face a lot of discrimination. We have a special report today about the Islamic religious revival in Indonesia, which has the largest Muslim population of any country in the world. Indonesia was a Dutch colony until after World War II. Then there were several authoritarian regimes until 1998, when there was a big shift to democracy. Recently, there have been some terrorist attacks. But in general, the new freedoms have led to a surge in religious observance and moderate politics that oppose extremism. Fred DeSam-Lazaro reports from Jakarta.
Jakarta looks like any other modern Asian capital, but here, alongside the glittering office towers, you'll also find imposing houses of worship. At the Istiqlal Mosque recently, about 10,000 worshippers gathered for Friday noon prayer. It's part of a religious revival that's been taking place alongside a booming economy in recent decades. It is visible in mosques and in malls. At this crowded shopping center, the most popular garment seems to be the headscarf.
I'm here because Islam tells women to wear the scarf.
This 40-year-old accountant began covering her hair 3 years ago.
I feel ashamed because I should have been wearing it since I was young, but at least I'm wearing it now.
Islam is making a comeback in Indonesia, along with democracy that began 10 years ago. Well, years after independence from the Dutch in 1945, and then under decades of Suharto's dictatorship, religion was officially tolerated at best.
Islam and the traditional customary laws were regarded as being backward and primarily blamed for the defeat of many Muslim countries under European rule, so that many of the earlier nationalist leaders, many of the educated elites, in fact, turned their back on religion. And among the younger generation, there seems to be a greater willingness both to be openly religious and to be modern and educated at the same time. I think maybe this was not just a search for a greater spiritual anchor, but also I think it's greater self-confidence.
She and others say this growth of religious expression is spawned by the new democratic freedoms. It's neither fundamentalist nor militant, notwithstanding recent terrorist incidents.
Indonesian police said
bombings in two Jakarta hotels killed 9 people last July, and a 2002 attack in the tourist haven of Bali killed more than 200. But religion scholar Ulil Abdullah, with the Liberal Islamic Youth Association, says such extremism is not widespread.
For some people, Islam as practice in this country is corrupted. Movies and food and, you know, lifestyle and so forth, it's pretty much influenced by the American cultures. So when radical Islamic ideologies was introduced by some activists to Indonesia, it appealed to young people. But that's, you know, the appeal is limited to a fringe in the society. I mean, it's not a predominant trend.
The more accurate gauge, he says, is Indonesia's recent election, in which secular incumbent Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono won easily. Islamist parties, which had surged to 40% of the vote in 2004, lost ground to less than 30%.
Some people feared that if democracy is, the democratic space is open, it will allow Islamist party to dominate the arena. That is not true.
Significantly, the reaction of the Islamist and other parties after the election indicates a commitment to democracy, says Anis Baswedan, a scholar of political Islam.
We have around 40 parties. Only 9 were able to gain seats in the House. Yet we do not see significant problems from supporters who are not having their parties in the House. Acceptance to political result, democratic result, is very important.
He says Indonesians, especially the 14% who survive on less than a dollar a day, have much more pragmatic concerns: food prices, the economy in general, and corruption. Even voters who'd like to impose stricter Islamic law or Sharia.
From what I understand about Islamic states, the people live in prosperity and the law is enforced very strictly. Those who steal, those who are corrupt, they cut off their hand, rather than here, where people who can bribe judges and police get away with things.
Yet Marta, who like many Indonesians uses just one name, voted for the secular president. So did his neighbor, Shamsuddin, who praises a government initiative that's helped the poor.
Number one is cash for poor families, and the second is cheap rice. We get $10 a month in cash and 15 kilos of rice. We are a Muslim family, but we are not that strict. I voted for the party that is already helping people. It doesn't matter whether it's Islamic or not.
That kind of sentiment has moved Islamist parties to the center.
People understand now, campaigning that we are Muslims, we are an Islamic party, this is a Sharia platform, does not sell. People ask, tell me what else? Tell me in reality, what will you deliver beyond these slogans?
We don't name it Sharia because if you name it Sharia, it's people then from beginning suspicious to see.
Fahri Hamza is a member of parliament with the most successful Islamist party called Prosperity and Justice, which joined the ruling coalition government. Although it once campaigned for Islamic law and more conservative women's attire, Hamza says they are happy to govern by consensus in a liberal democratic framework.
We are an Islamic party, but what we talk about Islam is Islam as the universal value, because we believe every religion, inspired by God. you know, we follow this direction that anti-corruption is Islamic agenda, clean government is Islamic agenda, you know, welfare, manage our economy, open economy, you know, liberalize our economy is one of the, good agenda.
That interpretation might well have its roots in the history of Islam in this vast, diverse archipelago.
We are used to living in differences. Indonesia is composed of islands, over 17,000 islands and over 700 different ethnic groups with different languages, different cultural traditions. Islam came to Indonesia fairly late, from 12th century up, mostly through traders and Sufi teachers. They found Indonesia already a very rich layers of cultures. And to be accepted, a new belief, a new religion, would have to adapt to local circumstances from the beginning. I think that was the case when Hinduism came here and when Buddhism came here, and then when Islam came here, when Christianity also came here.
So even though it's 85% Muslim today, Islam here reflects Indonesia's polyglot culture, readily evident in architecture, language, even in the mall scarf shops.
We believe in Indonesia that Islam is more modern, more moderate. People who wear the plain dress, it's not our way.
It'll look strange if an Indonesian woman wore that kind of plain clothes, especially nowadays. They probably think you're a terrorist wife.
Shop owner, saleswoman, and customer told us there's no contradiction between Islam and fashion, that the notion of a plainly dressed, fully covered woman is foreign. Shopping here was Nur Inani, who was buying for customers in her own clothing business in the island of Sumatra.
Mostly they are looking for clothes this long and this long, which is basically covering the butt and the arms. I look for the dress first, and then I will find the matching scarf, the color, the style.
Terrorist incidents aside, Indonesia is enjoying a period of stability rarely seen in its independent history. Indonesians are free to choose their government, and they're free to pursue religion. And they've made it clear in elections that they want to pursue each separately, that is, to keep religion out of government. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSam Lazaro in Jakarta.
A female journalist in Sudan was freed this week after being jailed for wearing pants in public. The case gained international attention. Lubna Hussein was found guilty of violating the country's decency laws. Under Islamic law, she faced a possible sentence of 40 lashes. Instead, she was assessed a $200 fine, which she refused to pay, but which others paid for her. Now, have you heard the one about the Cistercian monks who wanted business advice and the two Colorado women who are experts at online marketing? Bob Fall reports from Wisconsin.
For 900 years, this has been the hallmark, indeed the passion, of Cistercian monks: prayer, seven times every day. Nearly 5 hours each day are devoted, says the superior of this abbey, to the solitary pursuit of friendship with God.
It's really about a relationship with God, and prayer is just the word we give to the conversation and the relationship that we have with the divine person.
On nearly 600 remote acres in south-central Wisconsin, even private time, as when Brother Stephen Treat walks the Stations of the Cross, even that time is spent, he says, lifting his mind exclusively to God.
And the main part of our business is going into that church seven times a day and praising God and praying for the safety and well-being of the world.
Even when Father Bernard relaxes with his Spanish hot bloods Alejandro and Tanako, or with the ordinary Bert, there is meditation.
Theirs is about being and about awareness. And there's a quietness to them, obviously, for the most part. And so they're a very contemplative presence in our life.
The rituals, the routines here are familiar. But what sets this abbey apart is that while it keeps one foot in the 11th century, the other is firmly planted in the 21st. On the grounds nearby, with a background of Gregorian chants, is a high-powered internet operation.
How are they selling? Pretty well?
Run by two laywomen, which permits the abbey to flourish.
We allow them to be what they were put on the planet to be monks, to do good, to pray for the world.
All this began 7 years ago when Father Bernard went to buy toner for his printer.
I said, you know, wow, this is just way too expensive for a bunch of black dust or a few squirts of ink. You know, there's got to be a better way.
So in 2002, Father Bernard started Laser Monks, selling ink and toner to charitable groups at prices far less than office supply stores. In Colorado, online marketing experts Cindy Griffith and Sarah Coniglia noticed and gave Father Bernard a call.
He said, come on out to Wisconsin. He said, there's beer, you know, there's beer, there are brats. Come on out, we're on 600 acres and see what you think.
Sarah and Cindy didn't just visit, they stayed.
I saw an opportunity to take the monks where they needed to be, to take a business idea, the germ of an idea which he had, and turn that vision into a success.
It's a wonderful symbiosis that lets us use our talents, lets them use their talents, and helps us to do a lot of good work.
I would regard that as serendipitous. I gather you regard almost as providential.
Both. I would call it sacred serendipity.
Now they also sell deluxe coffee, benevolent blends with profits supporting families who pick the coffee beans. Also chocolates, creamy caramels, jams and jellies made in other monasteries. Sales last year were nearly $5 million. 80% of that was for expenses. But 10% went to fund the abbey, and the remaining 10% went to charity, from a camp for kids with HIV to Buddhists in Tibet.
So we're a for-profit whose bottom line is to not make any profit at the end of the year because it's all given away in some form or fashion. That's social entrepreneurism really at its radical best.
Their product line also includes benevolent biscuits, treats for dogs prepared in the abbey kitchen, rolled, stamped, and baked by the Cistercians themselves and sampled by the abbey's quality control officer, Ludwig, the abbey's Doberman pincher.
This is the general.
Here, no talent is kept under a basket. What Father Robert Keffer paints will someday be sold to help maintain the abbey.
You work during the work hours, you stop, you go to pray. It's a very, regimented is a wrong word, but it is a very disciplined life. So that's a little hard for an artist. You know, oh, I'm at this great inspiration, I can't stop and pray now.
Well, you have to.
You have to, and you most certainly can.
Benedict Domine nos et ictona tua, quede tua largitatis homos sumpturi.
So here, there is a balance between the rigors of monasticism and the demands of the marketplace in an abbey which is both in the world and apart.
We have cell phones, we have Wi-Fi, we have, you know, things like the normal world, but we know when to turn them off.
Even though that takes some getting used to, says Brother Stephen Treat, who left what he says was a satisfying job with a Quaker social service agency because he felt the need to do something more.
You do miss certain things, but you'd be surprised what you replace it with. That here I'm in a community of six guys that if all works out, I'll spend the rest of my life with them and with whomever comes after, and I'll be buried on that hill, and that falls into an 80-year history of this house and a 900-year history of this order.
And for those who contend this way of life, this withdrawal from the world, is ultimately selfish, Cistercians have an answer for that.
The Christian tradition understands places like this, contemplative monasteries, as these lighthouses, these beacons, where people are joined together in prayer and praying on behalf of the whole world.
Theirs is a calling which appeals only to a few, but a calling which transforms those who embrace its rigors. Just as being part of this community has changed a lapsed Catholic and a divorced grandmother.
Personally, I think I'm more grounded, more settled, more peaceful. The Abbey has brought that kind of religious part of me that I didn't have before I came here.
For me, it's been as much of a spiritual journey as it has all other types of journeys. It's really brought me back into the fold in a really slow, step-by-step, peaceful way.
So here, in this oasis of serenity, seven times every day, the psalms, the chants, will continue to echo.
In some ways, we perch a little bit more lightly on this planet. And, you know, we have one foot firmly planted in the earth and another one off in the heavens.
Here, where they live both simply and smartly, having learned, as one put it, only those who can see the invisible can accomplish the impossible. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Faw in Sparta, Wisconsin.
Last week, we had a story about Catholic priest Leo Patalinghug, who combines ministry and cooking. Food Network celebrity chef Bobby Flay had challenged Father Leo to a TV cook-off, making the priest's trademark steak fusion fajitas. This week, the duel aired. Father Leo won. On our calendar, during this last week of the Islamic month of Ramadan, Muslims mark the night of power when they believe the angel Gabriel revealed the first verses of the Quran to the Prophet Muhammad. According to Islamic tradition, this night is the time when God establishes the events to occur in the coming year. And the Jewish High Holy Days, which begin next Friday evening with Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and end 10 days later with Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, forgiveness. The process over that time is to make teshuvah, repentance. Our guide to the observances was Rabbi Erwin Kula, an author and head of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership in New York.
I think one of the interesting things about Rosh Hashanah in general and about the High Holiday period is that the celebratory aspect, which is Rosh Hashanah and the celebration of the new year, actually comes before the atonement focus, which is Yom Kippur. So you come out of Rosh Hashanah and say, new year, everything's sweet, it's amazing, life is good, and then, okay, well, given that, why not check out who I am? Teshuvah is this process over Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur in which we return to that place deep, deep down of who we really want to be. And so everything having to do with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, all the prayers and all the liturgical readings and all the readings from Scripture and the variety of practices, whether it's blowing a shofar or on Yom Kippur, it's fasting and staying in the synagogue for most of the day. All of the practices are designed to help us make teshuvah, return to that deepest path that we know we want to be on. There really are three basic questions that these 10 days invite us to think about. One is, can I change as a human being? Can I really become better? The second question is forgiveness possible? Can I forgive other people and can I feel forgiven? And the third question that runs through all of these days is am I accountable for my behavior? In the central prayer of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, who shall live and who shall die, that in that prayer it says, on Rosh Hashanah, it is written, in other words, your fate, your destiny, in a sense, is written down, is inscribed, and on Yom Kippur, it's sealed. Our behavior does affect the nature of our life. I don't know if it affects whether we literally live or die, but it surely affects whether we live or whether we die in life. If Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur work, at the end of Yom Kippur, there's a final blast. The last thing on Yom Kippur is a final long blast of the shofar. And at that moment, I should feel two things exactly at the same time. One is, I am really perfect and loved just the way I am. And I can do better. And to hold those two things together, I'm perfect and loved just as I am. And I can do better is the process of teshuvah working.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. We have much more on our website, including more about the Jewish High Holy Days and much more of our interview with Rabbi Irwin Kula. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you this week, Cantor Abraham Lubin from Congregation Beth El in Bethesda, Maryland.